Good afternoon. This is the time set for argument in case number 84563, In Re DC Jr. and DC Jr. versus State of Nevada. Is everyone ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, great. Mr. Westbrook. Sure. So as I'm sure you know, I'm just going to make sure everyone understands when it gets to 5 minutes, the yellow light will come on and the tone will sound, but the clock keeps going.
Thank you for the reminder, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Justices, Chief Justice Kadish, may it please the court. My name is David Westbrook, and I represent DC, a minor in this case. There's one thing I would like the court to keep in mind as we discuss the issues in this case, just as an overview. This is an actual innocence case. I believe very strongly that my client didn't do this. He could not have done this. The evidence shows that there were two men that were involved in these horrible crimes. One of them was 5'6" and between the ages of 25 and 30. The other one was between 5'11" and 6 feet tall. Neither one of them was a 14-year-old boy who was developmentally disabled. The police were led to my client because the men who committed these crimes were using his apartment to stage the case. Now, that's evidence that was presented to the juvenile court. I'm not going outside the record here. They were found because they were using his Wi-Fi, using his phone. We know that they were there because there were two items that they left behind, one of which was a very distinctive watch, green and gold, that would have been really hard to pawn. The other one was a sweatshirt. But you know what wasn't there? There was no weapon there. There was no ammunition there. There was no DNA tying my client to the scene of any of these crimes, no fingerprints. There were no gold chains in the apartment. There was no money in the apartment. Police arrived.
Where, Mr. Westbrook, I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but where? How does this relate to our competency concerns today?
There are two concerns that we raised, one of which was the competency concern, and one of which is whether there was a factual basis in this case in order to certify my client as an adult. Depending on how the court found on the competency, the second one will be more relevant. So his innocence doesn't relate to his competency. But I wanted to frame the case here and demonstrate to the court that it's very important to realize that the weight of the evidence shows that my client is innocent. And that puts me in a very difficult situation, not difficult compared to his situation, but a very difficult situation and a very upsetting situation. I would love to have gone to trial on this case. I wish my client didn't have competency concerns because I feel like I would have won this case already. He's been in custody for 874 days because I can't go to trial. And I will never be able to go to trial on this case because he is incompetent. He's been incompetent since the day he was arrested. He will be, according to an unimpeachable neuropsychologist, he will never be competent. This is a boy with an IQ, a full-scale IQ of 66. But even worse than that, this is a boy with a processing speed of 60. And the absolute worst memory index I have seen in 20 years almost as a public defender of 55. He cannot learn. He cannot retain information. I have been working with him now for 2 years. I wasn't initially on the case because, of course, it was in juvenile and I'm in the adult system. In 2 years, he hasn't made one lick of improvement. I have the same conversation every time I talk to him. When do I get to go home?
Mr. Westbrook, to that point, is the case stayed, or what's the current status?
The case is stayed.
Okay.
It was stayed in the district court. Now, as you know from reviewing my writ on this case, the case was also stayed in the justice court.
Right. But
that was a writ issue. The court said that we had a plain, speedy, and adequate remedy, which I assume we're doing today,
right.
The plain, speedy, and adequate remedy. So I won't talk about the writ unless you want to ask questions. But the case has been stayed several times, and it's currently stayed right now.
Okay, thank you.
I wanted to bring up, in the district court, I wanted to bring up custody status, but I wasn't allowed to because the case was stayed. As a threshold matter, it's our position that a child must be found competent to stand trial before the court may engage in a certification hearing, and that the court in this case did not apply the Dusky standard, which is competence to stand trial. And the state and I agree on this. There's no other standard in the juvenile system besides competence to stand trial. That's the standard announced by Dusky. That's what fits with our statutes and a review of our statutes. Particularly in prongs 2 and 3, there's no difference between the juvenile statute and the adult criminal statute. The only difference happens in prong 1, and it depends on whether you're talking about a delinquency petition or a Chins hearing, or whether you're talking about a criminal hearing. But that's it. And
so
and
Russell,
we've actually, yeah.
Would there not, though, be some difference in prong 2? And, I mean, the ability of, I don't know, a 10-year-old child to understand a court proceeding is likely going to be pretty different than what it looks like for somebody who's 30 in the adult criminal system.
Well, first, I actually think that they're remarkably similar. I mean, if you're talking about people of normal intelligence, I think there's been a lot of studies done that show that the average American is reading at between a 4th and 6th grade level. I don't think that there's a huge amount of difference really between an adult's understanding of the criminal justice system necessarily and a child's understanding, at least as it relates to prong 2. But in this case in particular, we're talking about whether or not to certify him as an adult, which I think is a pretty key distinction here. We're talking about a judge who needed to assess whether or not he was competent to stand trial so that he could be sent to an adult system and stand trial. So it doesn't make any sense to rule that, well, as the judge did, he's not competent to stand trial, and I can back all that up. I think that there'll be some conversation between me and the state, some disagreement as to whether or not he actually ruled that he wasn't competent to stand trial. I think it's very clear from the record that he did not rule he was competent to stand trial, that instead he said he's competent for the purposes of today's proceedings. Well, today's
relying on the statute that uses that phraseology.
Right. Well, both statutes use that phraseology, but that's actually an interesting point, Your Honor. If you take a look at the language of the statutes, which I have right here, 178.400 says, understand the nature of criminal charges is number one. Number one under 62D.140 says, understand the nature of the allegations of delinquency, or if the child is a child in need of supervision, the allegations. We've all conceded that he understands the charges, you know, be it in a criminal context or in a juvenile context. Obviously, delinquency is not relevant here because it's not a delinquency case. But he understands the criminal charges. Understanding the nature and purpose of the court proceedings, that has to do with the system, not the particular room that you happen to be in. It doesn't say this court's proceedings. It says the court's proceedings. Court is not...
Court proceedings, his court proceedings?
Means the proceedings of the court. In order to assess whether or not you're competent under the second prong, you have to understand not only the proceedings for the afternoon that you're in. You have to actually understand something about the court system in general. I think that's pretty clear in Missouri versus Frye, where they talk about, not in a competency context, but they talk about the importance of plea agreements to the entire judicial system. I don't think you can ever be found competent under Dusky if you don't understand what plea agreements are. And it's very clear, there was a finding of fact by the judge in this case that my client didn't understand what plea agreements were. In fact, so did the psychologists who somehow found my client competent, despite the fact that their own analysis showed that he wasn't competent. And they specifically ruled, at least one of them did, on the second prong that my client, that they were unclear whether or not he met the second prong of Dusky. I mean, unclear is not an unequivocal finding of competence. Unclear means that he's not competent.
Well, but didn't Brown find that it was, he did meet the second prong but was in need of refreshers? And it's concerning that there was no provision for those refreshers in the court's determination to me. But Brown did say that with refreshers he met prong two. Did she not?
She said it, but she qualified it so much that it really results in an unsupported ruling on her part. It's not a ruling. It's an unsupported.
And we don't have written findings from the district court judge, is that right? Yeah. So we only have the transcript.
That's all we have is a transcript. There were no written findings, which I think is a problem. And if the court is as concerned about that as I am, I think that the remedy is to send it back for a hearing. And after 2 years, it would have to be basically a start over on the competency issue. You know, something similar has been done in the past in other cases. This is a case where it needs to happen.
But let me ask you a question.
Why does Dusky require competency to stand trial in adult court when the proceeding was in the juvenile court?
Well, there's something in
the not a trial or even an adjudication of delinquency. It was a certification proceeding.
We have to understand the whole system in order to be able to aid and assist counsel, for one thing. It's not just on the second prong. It's also on the third prong as well. And you'll note from my brief, there were no distinctive, specific determinations by any of the court-appointed psychologists as to whether or not my client could aid and assist counsel. There was a very clear statement from his counsel that he was unable to do it, and a very clear statement from our neuropsychologist that he was unable to do it. But they didn't even assess that. Our attorney sat in on all of these meetings and said it wasn't even discussed during the meetings. So you can't aid and assist counsel if you don't say understand what guilty pleas are. And it's very clear that he did not understand what guilty pleas were. In fact, when the judge was talking about guilty pleas, plea agreements, he said something which I could not believe. He says, well, does he really understand the plea bargain? Well, the plea bargain really is a nomenclature that comes from the adult criminal side. It absolutely isn't. There are plea bargains in juvenile court. I'm holding them one right here. They say plea agreement right at the top. And they include a recitation of your constitutional rights, a waiver of rights, and a statement that says voluntariness of the plea. They're exactly the same as in the adult system. So the fact that the judge would say we don't really use plea agreements down here doesn't make any sense at all. And I do want to clean up a little bit on what Dr. Brown said. I don't think Dr. Brown found him competent on the second prong when you read the analysis. What Dr. Brown said was he's competent, but only to the level of a second or third grader. That's a 7 or 8 year old. My client was 14. He's not even competent to his own age level. He's competent only to the level of a 7 or 8 year old. And his competence only holds if he gets, in her words, frequent rehearsals right before he goes into court. That's not competence. That's trying to present the image of competence. And it's not substantial evidence that would support the court's decision on competence. With that, I'll reserve the rest of my time unless there are more questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Alexander Chen on behalf of Respondent State of Nevada. Mr. Westbrook said something interesting a moment ago. He said that the average person in America probably reads at a fourth to sixth grade reading level. Now, if this statement is true, then we're talking about Dennis, who he says is the worst intellectual individual that he's come across in his 20 years as a public defender, is deemed to have a second to third grade reading level. So the worst person IQ-wise that an individual that Mr. Westbrook has come across is only two reading levels lower than the average person, if his statistic is to be believed. Now, I'd like to talk about Dennis because that's what this case ultimately is about, and to talk about the individual in which this court's going to make a decision regarding. One of the things that was said about Dennis is the following. I've had the opportunity to work with Dennis every day since being detained at juvenile detention. I have been witness to a transformation that I have not seen in my tenure as principal at juvenile court schools. He began here shy, reserved, untrusting, lacking confidence in social skills, and with no desire to improve upon any of these characteristics. 223 days later, I am able to paint a different picture of Dennis.
Right, is that a mental health professional, though, Mr. Chen?
Well, this is a teacher who is educating Dennis. But again, part of the processing, Your Honor, in terms of saying whether he can understand what's going on has to do with his intellectual level and what he can understand. And I'd like to say two things about that.
But the competency statutes require evaluation by a certified mental health professional.
The court is able to consider all things per this court's precedent. So yes, there do have to be professionals who give the actual medical opinions, but the court's able to consider everything, which is why this statement was not included by the state in terms of trying to deny this individual certification. These statements and the multiple statements that come from Dennis's behalf and indicating not only was he improving, but he was receiving A's and B's. Structure for this individual, while he was in juvenile detention, all of a sudden he's receiving A's and B's. And wouldn't that make sense considering all the history that we read from all the medical professionals regarding his upbringing is how much of a lack of institutional processes in place. His family life is not secure. He has other things that are not secure. But all of a sudden, he goes to juvenile detention, starts receiving classes, and for the first time probably ever in his life that I've seen in the records, he becomes an A and B student.
Are you disputing the 66 IQ?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's necessary for me to determine, because I'm not a medical professional in that regard, to say whether 66 is sufficient
or not. Do you have evidence to dispute the 66 IQ?
Well, I think what I'd like to say with regards to that, Justice Kadish, is that when we're determining competency levels, and we have the medical professionals who are giving their opinions, I respect it, and I respect all three individuals who gave their opinions. However, in looking at the totality of the situation and looking at what type of person is the defendant, and is he able to understand what's going on, is he able to talk to his attorney, is he able to have a rational understanding, not a complete understanding, but simply a rational one, I think it's important to look at all of the factors, because otherwise, a number, this court has determined in most situations, is never alone enough.
What about the equivocation on prong two,
yes,
by both Drs. Brown and Forster?
So I'm surprised by it only because when reading all of the evaluations and when it comes to prong two, everyone talked to him about the court processes, and he did understand certain things about them. There were certain things that he apparently didn't understand as well, but I can attribute that as well, and this is kind of picking back.
Mr. Chen, one of the things that he didn't understand mm-hmm. was that you could plead not guilty even if you were in fact
sure.
guilty,
sure.
right? And that's one of the decisions that, at least in the adult system, he would be making entirely for himself. Like, how could we ever say he was competent to go through this process if he didn't understand that?
Because I think that's an educational issue, Justice Bell. And the reason that I say that is when, you know, in dealing with cases, just anecdotally perhaps, when dealing with cases, the number of times that when someone gets charged with a crime and enters a not guilty plea, now, you in the judiciary, us in the prosecutor's office, Mr. Westbrook in the defense side of things understands that's going to happen. Rarely are you going to have an individual who waltzes into court and immediately says, I'm pleading guilty to the charge. They plead not guilty as a matter of formality, but at the same time, trying to explain that to victims' families, for instance, is a hard concept because they're thinking, he said he's not guilty. Under what planet is this person allowed to say that they're not guilty when really that person knows that he did it? Now, again, that's a conceptual problem that then people have to explain to them.
He was still not understanding that after Dr. Brown had theoretically restored him to competency, at least in her opinion.
I think that there are two things to say about that. One, I believe that the court did take into account the fact that he was being less than forthcoming about some of his answers. But alternatively, I still think that he has a rational understanding of what's taking place. Ultimately, he knows what happens if he goes to trial and he's not found not guilty, he goes home. He's aware of that. He knows that if he's convicted at trial, he's going to do a lot of time in jail, I think is what he says. So ultimately, the concept, though, of trying to say not guilty versus guilty, and how can I possibly do this? I think with the aid of his attorney and with the aid of continued education, he would understand this. I was kind of thinking about this, and again, just kind of a story that came up. In jury selection recently, an individual who was a potential juror said that it would require four people based upon his religion to find that a crime had been committed against a woman. Okay? Now, that's certainly not the state of our law, but per this person's background and per where they came from and per what their belief system is, they believe that to be true. Now try explaining the American judicial system if that person were charged with a crime and explaining this is what the state of the law is. Are they going to believe it or not? Or are they going to require a lot of education to get rid of any thoughts and misconceptions they might have had with regard to the American judicial system and educate them about it?
Mr. Chen, but would you agree it's not just the person needs to be educated to be at a point that they actually understand. Like, not just like, you know, you can have a 2-year-old parrot back to you what you say to them, but they don't understand it. right? There's a difference between I can repeat back what you just said to me versus I actually understand and can now help my attorney. How do you think that applies here?
Well, all of his statements with regards to his interviews with the medical professionals indicate that he could talk to his attorneys about the cases, that he could tell them what happened. He had to be truthful with them because they had his best interests in mind. So ultimately, the indications certainly are that this individual passed the dusky prongs. And I think, as an abundance of caution, Dr. Brown noted that this individual would have to have continued sessions per the Slater method and other things. Even if there was no written order, though, if competency became a real concern, it would be raised again at the district court level.
Dr. Brown says, in juvenile court, because a parent is usually available to help a child, the prong to assist counsel is less sophisticated than for adults. Do you agree with that?
I'm sorry.
Could you
repeat that again? Sorry.
In juvenile court, because a parent is usually available to help a child, which is frankly not my experience, the prong to assist counsel is less sophisticated than for adults. Do you agree with that statement?
To an extent. I don't agree with the fact that juveniles generally have their parent in the system, so I would agree
and
with
you. And certainly not in this case, right?
Not in this case. So I would agree with you there. But in terms of what we're trying to do here and his understanding of the processes, understanding of what's happening in court, I do think that he's capable of learning it. And he's capable of understanding.
On a second, though, because we're not talking about prong two here, we're talking about prong three. The prong to assist counsel is less sophisticated than for adults.
Okay. So, ultimately, a juvenile probably doesn't have, in general, on average, the level of sophistication that an adult does. But I do think that with the guidance that he was receiving in juvenile detention while becoming educated, having a better structured environment, and the attorneys that care for him and have had continuous communication with him, it seems like he would fit the prong of, three, that he could be capable of assisting his attorney there.
But do you think there's a different test for kids than for adults?
I don't think there's a different test. I think with every situation, whether this was an adult case or a juvenile case, you'd have to look at the individual's background. You'd have to look at whether they understand what's going on. I mean, there is a difference, for instance, with a defendant who just refuses to talk to his counsel, who ultimately is not assisting counsel, but refuses to because of whatever conceptions that person has or beliefs that person has that they refuse to help their counsel. Would that person be deemed incompetent simply because of their refusal to assist counsel? I think it would depend. If the mental health showed that for some reason their belief was maybe not based in reality, then perhaps that would be the case. But if the person's simply difficult and there's no other indicia of any type of mental health issues there, then I don't think you could find them incompetent pursuant to Dusky. Simply,
there's a pretty strong suggestion in the record that the district court on the competency certification was looking at competent to understand the juvenile court adjudication and certification to adult court process. And in their reply brief, Mr. Westbrook makes the point, he says, and I quote, on page 22 of the reply, that the state has conceded that Dusky requires a finding that a defendant is competent to, underlined, stand trial, and that there is no different standard for minors. Do you agree that that is conceded by the state?
I wouldn't say that it's conceded by the state.
What would you say?
So I would say that Dusky and the language used in Dusky does talk about a trial only, but that was in the limited circumstance of that case.
So if there's a different standard for juveniles in this juvenile process, what is it?
Well, I think what the court was trying to say, and it goes on at length about the reason it was doing what it was doing, was you have to look, to me, you have to basically look at the fact that he's in court, and per the statutes, the individual has to understand the court proceedings, and the juvenile statute, I think on that 62D,
But the court proceedings at the moment, or the overarching, how that, you know, you're at a fork in the road, it could go, you could stay in juvenile court, you could go to adult court. If you go to adult court, you could have a jury trial, you could spend your life in prison. Like, how much is, do it, they need to understand?
At that point, it seems that it's more about the proceeding in front of them, because ultimately, they're not being adjudicated guilty of anything at that stage, nor can they help their attorney in not being adjudicated guilty at that stage. The purpose of this...
Would there have to be a separate competency evaluation for each individual proceeding then? Because it kind of seems like it would.
I don't think so. Ultimately, they discuss trial issues with DC in this case. So there is a record about what the individual knows about trial. And in fact, he knew a lot of things, as indicated by all the psychological reports. Was it perfect knowledge? Again, I don't think it requires it, but it wasn't perfect knowledge, and that's why there's a discrepancy about whether he was competent to proceed at that time.
This certification hearing, is a huge, that's arguably the biggest hearing that's going to happen in this case, right? If he's staying in juvenile, that's a whole different circumstance than getting certified up on murder charges, right? And so, I don't see how that could be somehow less competent than at a later point.
I don't think it's less competent. I think, though, at this particular stage, the court is looking at whether the person is essentially competent to proceed and determine that the individual is competent to proceed, especially. I think he wasn't trying to minimize what a trial was, but he was just saying, for the purposes of these hearings, we're certifying him, and he's competent to understand what's going on. And ultimately, what could have been presented that would change that outcome? Ultimately, at the certification hearing, defense then had to make a choice, and they talked about how good that Dennis was doing. Why is that? Because they had to make a choice to try to get him to remain in juvenile. So, of course, they had to then highlight how good he was doing. But now that we're talking about competency, all of a sudden, he's this individual who's apparently unable to comprehend anything about the case. And I just don't think that the record ferrets that out. I think there's substantial evidence that he did understand what was happening.
Let me move you, Mr. Chin, if I could, to a different topic in terms of the whether or not there was substantial evidence to justify the court's decision on competency. I read Dr. Jones-Forrester as saying that Dennis was not competent. I read Dr. Brown as saying that there was competence on all three prongs. So my question is really more specific to Dr. Forrester. May I continue, Chief?
Go ahead. Yes.
Sorry. Dr. Forrester kind of seems to say one of two things, or says two things. If the court believes that he's performing with me, i.e. Dr. Forrester, in a way that's true to his abilities, then I recommend further education, which I would read as not competent right now. We need to continue doing what we're doing. Then she says, if the court believes that he has greater knowledge than what he demonstrated with me, I guess in part because she was saying she felt like he wasn't really trying hard, then the court could find him competent. But I don't really see anything in what the court did to address how it decided that issue. That's kind of my problem, that there's not a written finding where the court says, in regard to Dr. Forrester, I believe Dennis was underperforming purposefully, and therefore I think he's competent. I struggle with not at the very least thinking there needs to be some type of remand for that.
Well, ultimately, yes, there was no written finding on this, but I...
Even in the transcript, and I'm sorry, I should have included
right.
that.
Right. So did the court find that it believed he was not putting forth a full effort, and thus there were arguably two experts who have found him competent?
Court's brief indulgence, but I don't think he made those specific determinations when he was going through it, but I think overall he did essentially say that based upon the information he was finding that the individual would meet all three prongs of it. But did he go forth and specifically say that he gave Dr. Forrester more credibility than perhaps the other experts? I don't believe that was ever said.
Could I just ask, I'm sorry, I know he's over time, but just because it wasn't addressed at all, what about Mr. Westbrook's initial statements regarding basically the prosecutive merit of the case,
sure.
Just initially as a threshold matter? I know that the bar is pretty low, but you know, this notion of actual innocence doesn't appear to be a whole lot there from the record that I reviewed anyway in terms of just the prosecutorial, the merit.
I think essentially this case, all inferences were not negated, nor do they have to be at this stage, but I would say that the police investigation led them to this place. One of the common things that we usually hear from defense side is eyewitness identifications are inherently unreliable. And I think that that can be the case, having practiced for a while, that they can be unreliable. Ultimately, though, you hope for more. Here, it was certain actual evidence, though, that brought the police to this individual's doorstep, brought them to finding the watch, brought them to finding his cell phone and all the documents that supported the fact that he was behind these shootings at the time. So I think that there is prosecutorial merit. I know that certainly Mr. Westbrook can have either his opinion or his belief that there's an actual innocence claim, but the day for trial should be the day where he certainly presents that evidence.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Westbrook.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Herndon, you're absolutely right. It has to be remanded at the very least because there aren't specific factual findings. I think that's required by Iwalifa. It's not enough to just go through the list of factors. There has to be a why, and there wasn't a why here at all. And this is also not a case like Tanksley, where you had, you know, two people who were saying competent and one person who wasn't sure. I don't think any of these experts on the court's appointed experts was sure of competency, particularly to the second prong, but I don't even think that they properly analyzed the third prong. Only two people actually testified with specifics as to the third prong. One of them was our expert, Dr. Jones Forrester, the neuropsychologist, who said, and I quote, he doesn't understand what is or is not factually important. And Justice Bell, that was something that you were asking about. You don't have to really get into the weeds on the difference between an adult's competence or a child's competence when what you're saying is, does he understand enough about what might be factually important to tell the attorney and have that conversation? Our attorney in juvenile said he couldn't do it and put that on the record. Dr. Jones Forrester said he couldn't do it and put that on the record. The other two experts didn't say anything about it. So he was not able to aid or assist counsel. He failed prong three as well. But as to prong two, again, he was only found competent by Dr. Brown to the level of a 7 or 8 year old, only with frequent rehearsals. And she talked in great detail about the need for constant restoration. And when doctors are talking about the need for restoration, that person's not competent. And I thought I heard Mr. Chen concede, in his own words, that education was required to get him to competence. I mean, I wrote it down, and what I heard was, with the aid of continued education, he would understand this. I mean, that's the elephant in the room, isn't it? We can all see that he didn't understand any of this. He's not competent. And the only debate is whether or not he could be made competent with further education. But he was never competent down below. And that's why the judge, in making a ruling, had to essentially change the Dusky standard. Because if you're applying the Dusky standard as it actually exists, with the law that we actually have, you have to find that someone is competent to stand trial. Everything else is just splitting hairs, and it's doing it along lines that simply don't exist.
Mr. Westbrook, sorry, one more minute. In Dr. Forrester's report, mm-hmm. she goes through in some detail each of the responses that he had given back in August and then later in February, and it seems like the implication from her point of view is that he is faking it or now claiming to know less than he knew even then at the beginning of this process. How would you respond to that?
In three ways. First of all, the judge didn't find that he was faking it. The judge did not find malingering. Second of all, she never tested for malingering. There are tests that you actually perform. You don't just go, when you're an actual psychologist or psychiatrist, you don't just go with your gut on whether or not he's malingering. You actually perform tests. Only one doctor did that, and that was Jones Forrester, and she said he is not malingering. Also, that was at the end of about an 80 or 90 minute session where she also said that he was very tired and was losing focus, And this is a kid who doesn't process well, and he has bad, bad short-term memory. The idea that he would forget is perfectly in line with all of his scoring from the clinical evaluations of Dr. Jones-Forrester. There are no other questions? Then I guess that's my time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. We appreciate the opportunity.
All right. We appreciate the briefing and the argument today.